This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Kelly. Our guest this week is Mark Eisley, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NCBA's Mark Eisley next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Unlike the market for row crops, cattle producers are seeing good prices for their livestock, thanks in part to great consumer demand, both domestically and globally, as well as a reduced number of animals. Wyoming rancher Mark Eisley says producers are facing headwinds, but for now, the bottom line is marked with black ink.
Prices are good. We've got a lot of backstop with some protections that the Farm Bill has allowed us. Producers are becoming more and more inventive and creative. They're adopting technology, especially as their younger producers are coming on. They're quick to make light of that. And we have to because we have a smaller labor force. I think we do an exceptional job. We may even be victims of our own success to some degree. I think we have a great market. We have a great trade balance going on where we're sending stuff off. Our product is in high demand. And I think that higher cattle price, unfortunately some of it's due to the reduced numbers, but at the same time, it's really good for us. We haven't had that break in several years, so I think most producers are very grateful for that.
Mark, let's talk about headwinds and just list the things that you see challenging ranchers today.
Well, I'll break that into two categories. I like to look at it as the cost of the business, you know, inputs, fuel, feed, equipment, labor, and all the supplies that go into running an operation. Whether you're running row crops, if you're feeding cattle, if you're whatever the case might be, the cow-calf operator, those costs are way up. I think the second consideration is the challenges that the government, the administration, whether it's a state or national, even sometimes local, present for us. And that is the ability to operate freely, the overregulation we see from agencies, the inability to access that relief when we need it, or just straight out challenges that are overwhelming, like endangered species or tax law changes, those sort of things.
So thinking then about some of these challenges, I've seen the cattlemen make strong statements with regard to disagreement over endangered species. Saw the cattlemen really make a strong case on the WERDA regulations that were coming from the Environmental Protection Agency. But lately there has been discussion, I think it centers in South Dakota, and it's called the Maud case. Can you give the background of that and why this is something that NCBA is raising now as an issue?
Oh, absolutely. The Maud family has been ranching in South Dakota for five generations. And more recently, there was a fence line dispute between Charles and Heather Maud and the U.S. Forest Service. And this led to their indictment in federal court. And this is really troubling for all ranchers across the country, because, especially public lands guys, because these boundary issues are actually fairly common, especially when you consider unique land management issues in the West. In many parts of the West, land boundaries were set up with old maps and primitive surveying methods. So it's common to see some confusion over where the boundary is. In this case, the dispute is over 50 acres of land that they've owned and managed. And they were trying to resolve this. They were trying to work through this. They were trying to mitigate it. They've been great stewards, and they really want to make this work. This is not unusual. This happens quite often. And the Forest Service usually deals with these quietly. They mitigate them and to everybody's benefit and satisfaction, quietly, without huge legal disputes. it was nothing that they had intruded into. I believe this was already an established piece of ground that they truly felt was within their interior boundary. When it was discovered it was not, that's when they decided to have several meetings and try to come to resolution with a special use permit or a land trade. And instead, Forest Service halted their meetings and escalated this to a federal crime indictment for theft of government property. The Forest Service is supposed to be a collaborative partner with ranchers. So this heavy-handed legal action was really troubling to ranchers everywhere, and it should be.
So this falls under the Department of Agriculture. And yes. When the meeting stopped, then what happened? And how is this being handled?
Well, NCBA was the first ones and maybe the only ones that have really stepped up to protect the Maud family. We've been in contact with members of Congress to get them up to speed on this issue. And in particular, Senator Mike Rounds has been involved and is sharing his concerns with USDA Secretary Vilsack. And so we hope we can resolve it this way. We may have to have some meetings and some discussion at one of the House committees to get this resolved, or at least shed some light on what's happening and why.
How has the Forest Service personnel treated the Maud family?
Well, my understanding through several different discussions is that the individual, the law enforcement agency, and I usually have great respect for law enforcement agencies, even with public lands enforcement, difficult. And those guys do great, they do great heavy lifting. But in this case, I understand the individual has always had a history of being kind of heavy-handed, and the supervisor for that Forest Service decided to weigh in and continued along with this legal challenge and indictment of the family.
So under WERDA, you had farmers that are ranchers that had land or wanted to build a pond or do other things, and under WERDA, you went from fines and challenges in a courtroom. This is a case where legal action is against them, and they've been accused of a crime.
Yes, that's exactly correct. And I have seen this several times, not the legal charges, but where there's been disputes. I've seen where there's actually been houses built on forest property and maybe sold to an unsuspecting or uninformed purchaser, and then they have reached out to the Forest Service. Forest Service has reached out to them and said, you'll have to take the house down and move it to your own side of the property. And they've always done that. It's always been a collaborative effort. There's been agreeable discussions. There's been great mitigation. So that's why this appears to be so heavy-handed for no apparent reason.
Have you had experience in working with government like this before, Mark?
I have. I have a Forest Service permit. We had been challenged on several issues. And we always found that by reaching out to the forest ranger, the district ranger, the forest supervisor, and in some cases our delegations, we always came to a resolution that was beneficial to everybody. We're our partners in this thing, and the theft of this land is kind of a silly accusation. Are we going to pick it up and take it to somewhere and sell it? No, it's right there. It's not going anywhere. Just solve the dispute and let everybody continue on with their jobs.
It seems as though this goes against what the Department of Agriculture has presented as a kinder and gentler and easier to work with agency.
It goes exactly against it. We're seeing the similar effects with the Bureau of Land Management, in particular when they proposed their conservation land rule, and they did that without any input from local economies or field personnel. And just a heavy-handed approach to this is what we're going to do. We're going to throw it out there and see what sticks to the wall. Not a good way to be treating your collaborative partners.
As it happens right now, what's happened to the Maud family? Where do they stand?
They've been charged. They're actually trying to make guardian receivership possible for their children in case they end up serving prison time, which would be a shocker. But some judges would lean that way. And that's what a tremendous amount of stress and financial distress it would cause a family for something like this with the best of intentions.
So now let's move up a little bit further. The Supreme Court, not long ago, made a decision in the Chevron case that said agencies don't have the opportunity to fill in for vague legislation. How could this affect endangered species? How could this affect WERDA? And is this something that NCBA is paying attention to?
Yeah, we're tuned up to this one. We were really proud that the Supreme Court came out with their decision on Chevron deference, because the problem had been when Congress, for lack of a better term, was too lazy or unable to put something in statute, there was deference to the agencies to go ahead and do whatever you need to do, make this up to fill the gap, and issue some rules or regulations to cover this thing. And they really went wild with some of this. And some of it we have a difficult time pulling back and having some common sense approaches used. So the potential here with the Endangered Species Act, and I'll make a preface to that. Where are they finding endangered species the most commonly? They're finding it on private ground. Why are they finding it on private ground? Because property owners are already doing the right thing. We love the environment. We love clean water, clean air, all those things. And we love wildlife. So we're doing our best. But here's what happens. You end up with something like this, and the Endangered Species Act allows the agencies to write rules. And I've been under threat of this before, where they did not actually ground truth critical habitat. They drove around and literally circled things on a map and said, that's what we're going to do. We had our public hearings after the comment period had closed. It's pretty tough to state your case or defend your position when it happens like that. You can see this move forward with the Chevron deference, where we actually develop some protection. And one of the things that comes to mind is the potential listing of the monarch butterfly and the habitat for it. There's habitat in all 50 states. They could literally condemn something on everybody's property and stop the use of it because of the ESA. A lot of folks have turned a blind eye to this because, well, I don't have wolves, or I don't have grizzly bears, or I don't have sage grouse, or whatever the case might be, a snail, a snake, a bird. They're all important, but to hit us with a big, heavy hammer is not going to contribute to the solution. I actually worked out something with Fish and Wildlife Service on a threatened plant that we had. We went into a 10-year study. They found out that the landowner, myself, was correct, and we decided to pull any listing of that plant, which was a huge relief. It took 10 years, but we got through that. There was no legal challenge. There was no punitive action taken against us. It was collaborative. That was good, but it took time to come to that resolve, and to have something happen shortly, quickly, immediately would have been brutal. We would have lost our hay ground, our ability to irrigate, and our ability to manage for the benefit of both the ranch and wildlife.
Mark, I wonder if we're better off, especially if now there is question of vagueness in a law that now a judge and a court will decide instead of a regulatory agency.
We would rather have it go that way because we can at least defend that in court if we have to and present the facts. And I think that's better than when the regulatory agency handles it, because good case of the waters of the U.S. We got a great ruling from the Supreme Court on that. Very distinctive. We've had 40 years of back and forth trying to hit a moving target, and now we have definitive answer. And what is the EPA and Corps of Engineers trying to do? They're trying to thread the needle on ways to go around the law, which was not the intent of the Supreme Court ruling. So once again, I roll back to the agencies can be heavy-handed if they want to, and we need clearness and clarity in those statutes.
If we talk to the crop farmers across the country, they'll say they want a farm bill because the safety net is broken because of the high price of planting crops and the inputs and the rest of the economic challenge they face. They'll talk about ARC and PLC, and they'll talk about crop insurance. But from the cattleman perspective, what are the elements of the farm bill that are really at the top of the scale?
Well, the whole farm bill is critical, and it doesn't matter if you're a row crop guy or a livestock guy. Hats off go to G.T. Thompson, who's head of the Ag Committee, the House Ag Committee. He has gone out and ground-truthed everything. He's talked to people. He's taken testimony. He's looked at the old farm bill. He has done yeoman's work and then some. And he's educated. It's been amazing. And what most people I've talked to who have long experience with this is the best farm bill that has been proposed in the last five farm bills. Hands down, this is the best, and it does all the best things we need. It's got the National Animal Vaccine and Countermeasures Bank for foot and mouth disease and other bad biologicals. We've got all the conservation practices that remain in there, things like EQIP. We've got the price protection for livestock if the price falls off. We've got all the additional insurance programs for row crops and, of course, pasture, rangeland, and forage insurance, which covers part of that, plus also droughts and those kind of concerns, wildfires and such. And if we could get this passed, it would be a very, very good bill.
Risk management and especially disaster relief programs, how could they be amended to be more beneficial for cattlemen?
Well, first of all, the money has to be in place. And second of all, the agencies that oversee that have to be very quick to their responses. There's guys that in Florida that are still not recovered from the hurricanes. They still haven't gotten fences built. They haven't got those animals contained the way that they need to be. And so that is the speed of commerce. You need to get that done. Same with the wildfires and the loss of grazing permits and the damage to private lands. Entire watersheds are at risk when you have those fires and they're not taken care of properly. So those things make a huge difference. I guess what I'm saying is the speed of which they're handled is critical.
As you mentioned, the National Animal Vaccine and Veterinary Countermeasures Bank, is that adequately funded, or are there areas that you feel like you're still vulnerable and need help there?
We have some vulnerability, and we would really like to see that fully funded. And I think the thing that people don't realize is that vaccine does not have an infinite shelf life. It has to be reconstituted and restocked and made available in quantities that are available to handle immediate outbreaks. And if you have an outdated vaccine or you have insufficient quantities of vaccine, you're at risk.
Finally, where would you be in the cattle industry without the checkoff? And how do you stand up for a program that continues, according to many, to be a benefit to the industry? How big are these threats to the checkoff, and where would you be without it?
Well, there's some tremendous threats to the checkoff. This OFF Act, the Opportunities for Fairness in Farming, is absolutely an animal rights activist bill, and it's meant to target animal agriculture. They support the OFF Act because they're opposed to animal agriculture, and they don't want us to market our products successfully to consumers. That being said, we have to make sure that the beef checkoff stays in place. It's not a tax. It was a voluntary thing. It survived some referendums. The producers come out in support of it. And the return on this thing, for every dollar you spend on the checkoff, you get back, and the audits have come back. We've had 5 audits, all clean, all absolutely above reproach. It's returning $13.40 for every dollar that people buy. If I had that kind of money invested in the stock market, I wouldn't have to do anything else for a living. I'd be set forever. But it also shows that when the beef checkoff, when we had these studies, they showed that if the checkoff hadn't existed between 2019 and 2023, beef demand would have been off another 2.5 billion pounds. That's billions with a B. It would have been 8.5% lower, and the price of steers would have been off down 7.8%. And the demand for our exports would have been almost over 370 million pounds less. That's about 11%. And you have to remember, some of those exports are stuff we cannot sell here in the United States. Consumers don't want. Those kind of things bring real value to our producers. And by promoting those in other countries and other offshore places, that brings real value to all of our producers. So whether you support the checkoff or not, you have benefited from the checkoff. And if you think about the other things that happen within the country where we do promotion and research and education, that affects things like the dietary guidelines. That affects school lunches. And of course, my favorite is what the military gets fed. We want to make sure that they're fed real beef and not lab cultivated protein. So the Checkoff is absolutely wonderful. It's constantly innovating and helping drive demand. We work for the consumers, pure and simple.
So if we talk about the tailwinds, those things that are helping you, the consumer demand in the U.S. to continue buying beef, even at higher prices, I believe you'd have to say that's a positive for the industry.
It's an enormous positive for the industry. We have a product that's incredibly versatile. If it's prepared properly, it has huge, huge versatility. I mean, there's just no way around it. It's a great supplement to diets. No one celebrates a big deal with a chicken leg. They celebrate it with a steak. And I think the fact that consumers and restaurants continue to sell at what I consider to be record levels tells me that people love beef. They love to have it. They love to serve it. And they're very confident in the product.
So there are those who would like to talk about the dietary guidelines from a climate perspective and use climate as an evaluation point for what should be included in the American diet. Where do cattlemen stand on that?
Well, I'll tell you where NCBA stands on it, and we've got the research to prove it. Cattle only produce 2% of the greenhouse emissions. 2%. Transportation, and that's trucking and airlines and everything else, is over 24%. If you took all the cattle out of the equation, you would still have a similar amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So if that's a nil point, all it does will affect land quality and land use and to the detriment, not to the positive.
Well, the one thing that I note from this is that toward the sustainability story is that cattlemen are producing more meat with less animals than you ever have before. So from a sustainability standpoint, you're going above and beyond what some others have even considered.
I know most industries are envious of our ability to become efficient or what we do. We're raising the same amount of beef with 30 to 40% fewer cattle. We have a lighter carbon footprint than we did 40 years ago. I think we're doing things in a more sustainable manner. Our awareness has been raised. We're using all kinds of modern technology and some old school techniques to make sure we stay on track. I think we have a record we can stand on and can be very proud of.
Well, Mark Isley, we'd like to thank you very much for taking time out of your travel schedule and working there on the ranch in Wyoming to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Mark, this is called Open Mic, and today you have the last word.
Well, I appreciate the privilege and the honor of working in NCBA and working for our members and our folks out there out there in the livestock industry. We do our best every day, and we always feel free to field any questions or concerns that folks have. And I hope I meet some of you out there on the road. I look forward to it. I've met some amazing people and seen some amazing places. I feel confident about the future of what we do.
Our thanks to Mark Isley, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.